Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited down for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. When and how you die isn't usually up to you. But in Vermont, sometimes it can be. It's legal in the state to get a prescription from a doctor for medication that will hasten your death if you meet certain requirements. Vermont's medical aid in dying law has been on the books for 10 years now. And recently, Vermont Public's Brave Little State got a question from a listener about it. I went out and reported on it for them, and I have to say, I learned so much in the process. Today, we're going to share that full Brave Little State episode with you. Later, we'll have a live conversation with Dr. Jana Clow, a doctor who specializes in end-of-life care. We'll open the phone lines to take your questions and thoughts on the subject. But first, let's hear the episode.
They were a dashing couple in their youth. Stan was handsome with black hair, and she was...
He was tall, dark, and handsome, and she was short and blonde.
5'2", eyes of blue.
Yeah.
And they, he was the local farmer, she was the local teacher. They got married at the Old West Church. It was kind of a classic romance.
Elaine always had a twinkle in her eye.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
They both had great senses of humor.
Yeah.
So what was the Fitch house like growing up? Like, what were some of your earliest memories?
It was an active dairy farm, so there were cows all around, and you could hear the compressor going in the milking house night and day. And
hear my father calling the cows to the barn at night.
Yeah.
Did you all grow up helping out on the farm?
No, we were girls.
We were girls.
Yeah.
Daddy always read to us when we went to bed, and... Or he would make up stories, and they would be serial stories with a different episode every night. And I can remember the smell of him, like cuddling up to him.
Yes,
when he was reading to us.
Well, I remember crawling into their bed, and he'd be out at the barn, but you could smell the hay on his pillow. I'm Donna Fitch, and I am 70 years old, and I'm the oldest daughter of Stanley and Elaine Fitch.
I'm Diane Fitch. I'm 68 years old. I live in Callis, Vermont, in a little house across the road from my parents.
I'm Judy Fitch Robert. I'm 63. I also live in Callis on land that was originally part of the family farm.
And I'm Michaela Lafrac. Stanley and Elaine Fitch, Donna, Diane, and Judy's parents, were married for 71 years. They lived their whole lives in the Callis farmhouse that Stanley grew up in. Their marriage had its flaws, but overall, it was strong and good.
What did you learn about, like, partnership from them, from watching them?
They were Vermonters.
But so are we.
But they could be quite quiet and stoic about, particularly about emotions. But you know what I learned the most is that friendship is the core part of any marriage.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And if you don't have friendship, then it's going to be very difficult to make it through 71 years or more or less.
As they got into their 90s, Stanley and Elaine's health began to decline, a mix of heart problems and old age. Last year, within a couple months of each other, they were both put on hospice care. Stanley was 99, Elaine 93.
So the quality of their life had really diminished.
And Daddy, he just loved being outside. He gardened into his 90s. He would toot around on his tractor. He felt so proud that he kept the farm in good shape. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't do that anymore. So he would sit in his chair and look out the window and see all the things that he couldn't take care of, that he couldn't do anymore.
They always said they didn't want to linger.
Yeah. My mother was saying that they wanted to be able to go when they wanted to go and that they were ready to go.
On August 30th, 2022, a Tuesday, the family gathered together in the farmhouse. Elaine had coffee in the kitchen. Later, Stanley joined her, read the funnies in the paper. Then Elaine got hungry. They weren't supposed to eat, so she let the girls know, it's time.
Yeah. We each took turns talking to them and saying whatever we needed to say for closure. But most of the closure was really joyful and loving, mm-hmm. and memories and jokes, and there was a lot of laughter.
Yeah,
sharing experiences.
One of the things I love that Donna said was, she said, "We forgive you for the mistakes you made as parents, and we hope that you forgive us for the mistakes that we made as your children."
And they did.
Stanley and Elaine were sitting next to each other in their recliners. They each drank a little apple juice mixed with a lethal dose of drugs prescribed by a doctor. The family sang and held their hands. Then Stanley and Elaine Fitch died in the same way they lived, together.
My father was born in that farmhouse.
He was born in the room
where he died. And it was the next room over there. But he was always in that farmhouse. And they'd always been in the same bed. And we'd spend nights there. We could hear them talking. They were, of course, deaf, so they were talking quite loudly. But, you know, "I love you. I love you, too." You know, yeah. It was very, yeah. Yeah. You know, they had each other to the end. And I think that was also what they really wanted, was to have each other to the end.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted for them.
And our gift to them, it was so that they could stay in their home. And then their gift to us was sharing the ending with us, but also giving us this shared experience. Mm-hmm. And that was the gift that we have this for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm. They chose the time, and they chose to go together.
You're listening to Brave Little State, Vermont Public's listener-powered journalism project. I'm Josh Crane. Here on the show, we answer your questions about Vermont, our region, and its people, because we think our journalism is better when you're a part of it. Today, Michaela Lefrak answers a question about medical aid in dying. That's when a physician legally prescribes a medication that a patient uses to bring about their own death. Michaela explores how the process works in Vermont and shares stories from the people who support Vermonters in their final days.
Death is a part of life, and we want to make it as good as it can be for people.
We have support from Vermont Public Sustaining members. Welcome.
Okay. It's time to talk about death, specifically medical aid in dying. It's a process that's only legal in some states, 10 of them to be exact, in Washington, D.C. Vermont legalized it a decade ago. Around that time, there was a lot of debate about it, but that debate's quieted down. That silence is part of what prompted Charlie Bastard of Heartland to submit a question to Brave Little State.
Why did this topic interest you?
Yeah, I guess it is a little morbid. For the record, I'm not terminally ill or sick, and I'm not really obsessed with death or anything like that.
Yes, death can be terrible and heartbreaking, but it's coming for all of us, after all. And if we can prepare for it, shouldn't we?
I had this question swirling around in my mind for some time, and so one day I just figured, oh, what the hell? I'll ask. And the rest is history.
Charlie's the first person I talked to for this story, and I hear something from him that I'll go on to hear from every person in my reporting. Charlie has lost someone he loves, and that loss changed the way he thinks about death. For Charlie, it was a friend who died of ALS.
A very undignified, slow way to watch a friend go out. I don't know whether he would have availed himself of that law or not. So those were all the kind of things that are in my mind when I ask a question like that. And I wonder, sitting here healthy and happy, if I were put into that position, would I actually have the braveness, the guts to go through with something like that?
Thus, Charlie's question to Brave Little State.
My question is about medical aid in dying. How many Vermonters use this option each year, and how does the medical establishment view it?
You've probably heard lots of different words and phrases for this concept of taking legally prescribed medication in order to die.
These days, it's most often referred to as medical aid in dying. In Vermont, some people just call it Act 39. That's the name of the legislation that ultimately turned into law. You might have also heard the term death with dignity. Advocates often use that one. People who don't support it often call it assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide. Euthanasia also comes up. That's a term that's more often used, again, by people who don't support the idea.
It's not so complicated, but there's lots about medical aid in dying and Act 39, and I use those two terms interchangeably.
Tony Kading is a retired nurse who volunteers for a helpline, answering questions about medical aid in dying. The helpline is run by Patient Choices Vermont, the main advocacy group that worked to get Act 39 passed. Tony offered to talk me through some of their more frequently asked questions.
We used to get a lot of calls that were, why isn't this suicide? Aren't you promoting suicide? And I think over time, in my experience with the calls, they have become much more informed, much more nuanced. They come with a basic level of knowledge so that the questions are more sophisticated.
These days, she says she gets lots of questions like this.
How do I move to Vermont? What's the residency period for living in Vermont?
The residency requirement is one of the many strict rules within Act 39. To qualify, you have to be at least 18 years old, and you have to have a terminal illness, meaning a doctor's determined that you have 6 months or less to live. You have to be able to make an informed and voluntary request and be able to self-administer the medication. You also have to be a Vermont resident, which is the part that lots of people ask Tony about.
I guess the first answer is, if a person wants to move to Vermont to use this law, we really discourage that. It's not the way the law was intended to work. And even if residency was established, it's pretty hard to find a doctor who is willing to accept a new patient solely for the reason of hastening their death.
There's also a strict process for getting the prescription. You have to make 2 verbal requests to a doctor at least 15 days apart. You have to make a written request in front of 2 witnesses. Then a second doctor has to confirm that you qualify. It's a lot to navigate. Tony tells me about what it's like for her to talk to people who are trying to come to terms with their own mortality and, at the same time, manage the ins and outs of this law. It seems so hard. So I ask a question that's been on my mind throughout my reporting. How do you deal with all this heaviness? She tells me, gently, that actually I have it all wrong.
You know, I don't approach it like that. I remember that when I was working with oncology patients, and these were the sickest of the oncology patients, people would say, oh, how can you stand that? Oh, isn't that just terribly depressing? Oh my gosh. And my response then is pretty much what it is now. These are the most alive people I ever deal with. They understand where the importance of life, they understand the risk of losing it. They are just the most real people with the most real concerns. And if I can help that, I'm so happy to do that. And I come away with those conversations, maybe teary, but oh my gosh, so grateful for my own life and what I have. So it's hardly ever a downer for me. It makes me grateful.
Our question asker, Charlie, wants to know how many Vermonters have used medical aid in dying since it passed. According to the Vermont Department of Health, only 1 person used it in the law's first year, 2013. The next year, 5. The year after that, 16. Fast forward to last year, 40 people used it. In total, 172 people have used Vermont's medical aid in dying law to hasten their death. The state also keeps track of the diagnoses of the people who used it. As of 2021, more than 3/4 of them had cancer. Just over 10% had ALS, and about 5% had neurodegenerative conditions. So 172 people total. It's a relatively small number compared to other states. For example, more people than that used medical aid in dying in Oregon in 2021 alone. But that number, 172, still represents a lot of individual people, each with their own full life and story. And rather remarkably, there's one Vermonter who's met dozens of them.
Hi, is this Steve?
Hi, Steve. This is Michaela LaFrac. I've been so curious to ask you so many questions.
Okay, go for it.
Steve Hochberg runs Smilin' Steve Pharmacy. It's a family business. He works with his wife, sons, daughter-in-law, grandkids. Its Rutland location is the only pharmacy in the state that fills prescriptions for the medical aid in dying medication. Steve says he hand-delivers almost all of them.
I've got one tomorrow, is that right?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How far are you driving to deliver it?
Tomorrow, about an hour.
Okay.
But I'll go anywhere in the state.
Yeah.
You know, we're central, so I could be anywhere within 2 to 2.5 hours in either direction. I don't mind the drive.
Making house calls allows Steve to answer people's questions about how to administer the drugs. I ask him to talk me through it.
It's a two-step process, but it involves 3 medications.
Okay.
The patient starts with some tablets, which help with nausea and vomiting, and one that helps swallowing, because you have to be able to obviously drink about 3 ounces of liquid that's kind of chalky.
Mm.
Patient has to wait about 20 minutes, and then they have this powder, which they're going to mix with apple juice, about 3 ounces of apple juice, swirl it all around, and then has to go down within a minute or two. Within 2, 3, 4 minutes, you're going to be totally asleep, totally unconscious, and that would be the last thing you ever remember, that you will now have the peace you're looking for.
Every Vermonter, it seems, who spends time in this space, doctors, nurses, hospice workers, patients, their families, they all know Steve. He delivered the prescriptions to Stanley and Elaine Fitch.
That was the first time ever I had 2 people in the same household.
Wow.
It was a great, oh my God, they were just super people. Oh yeah.
He didn't tell me their names or anything, but the Fitch sisters confirmed he was talking about them. And like with almost everyone I talked to for this story, there's loss in Steve's heart too.
My mom died when I was 17, and I saw her suffer for months and months and months and went through all the stages of cancer. And it's so cruel and it's so hard on the patient, but it's also extremely difficult on the family.
In a way, Steve's mom is with him in the car every time he drives to deliver the medication. She's the reason he's a pharmacist.
I believe it or not, it was my mother's suggestion. I always liked math and science, and she goes, oh, about pharmacy. Well, that sounds good. And so I got involved. Unfortunately, she didn't live long enough to see me start college. I basically died 3 days after starting college, but wow. I just loved doing it. I said, this is what I'm going to do.
Steve's been a pharmacist now for almost 50 years. Steve has a couple of guesses as to why he's the only pharmacist that fills these prescriptions. For one, you have to be what's called a compounding pharmacy to prepare these medications. Pharmacists at compounding pharmacies have special expertise to mix ingredients to make customized medications. Big national chains like CVS and Walgreens don't run compounding pharmacies here in Vermont. Then there's the threat of legal action. Act 39 has always extended legal immunity to prescribing doctors. But nurses and pharmacists weren't sure they'd get those same protections if, for example, someone's family member sued them. Then last year, legislators passed an update to the law, making it clear that all licensed healthcare workers involved in the process, including pharmacists, would be granted immunity. The update also allows patients to request the medication in a telehealth appointment instead of in person. So far, that update hasn't led to more compounding pharmacies in Vermont. They're still a complicated type of business to run. There are also some other changes underfoot. Remember that residency requirement? There's a push to loosen it.
I just want to make sure you're aware that there's a lawsuit that is pending that challenges the requirement in Act 39 that that the patient be a Vermont resident.
Betsy Walkerman runs Patient Choices Vermont, the main advocacy organization for Act 39. I'd heard of this lawsuit before. The patient at the center of it and her doctor came on the show I co-host, Vermont Edition, a couple months back. The patient lives in Connecticut and has terminal cancer. She wants to come to Vermont to use Act 39.
I'd like to choose how my final days are going to look. And that's why I am seeking out this change in Vermont's residency requirements.
Patient Choices Vermont isn't involved directly in this lawsuit, but Betsy Walkerman is watching it closely. Medical aid in dying is one of the only medical procedures that's restricted based on what state you live in. The other big one, abortion. The main difference there is that you don't have to be a legal resident of a state to travel there to get an abortion.
Personally, for me, the important thing is the broader implication of bodily autonomy and people being able to decide about their own medical care.
And Vermont isn't the only state taking a close look at how its medical aid in dying laws work. After a similar lawsuit last year, Oregon is no longer enforcing its residency requirement.
So right now we're just watching the lawsuit and interested to see whether Vermont can take the same step.
Betsy tells me medical aid in dying laws look different in other states and countries. In Canada, for example, it's legal nationwide. Around 10,000 people used it there in 2021. And in Canada, you can qualify even if you have more than 6 months to live. People with certain chronic or longer-term illnesses, like Alzheimer's, are eligible. Some Vermonters with Alzheimer's think they should have access to medical aid in dying, too. It's a topic of debate, both in Canada and the U.S.
When we come back, the second half of Charlie's winning question. How does the medical establishment feel about all of this? That's coming up next.
Medical aid in dying was a controversial idea when it was first introduced in Vermont. For the most part, the debates quieted down since it became legal in 2013. In part, that's because there really haven't been any instances of the law being abused that we know about. But it's still a topic that doctors have mixed feelings on. To learn more, I head over to Dr. Zale Berry's house. She's a retired physician living in Burlington.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Very cool to meet you.
Oh, you as well. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Berry specializes in end-of-life care. She worked with AIDS patients in San Francisco in the 80s, then moved to Washington, D.C. in the 90s, before eventually moving to Vermont. When she was in D.C., there was a lot of open debate about what was then called euthanasia, spurred by the case of Dr. Jack Kevorkian. He was a doctor in Michigan who is said to have assisted more than 130 people in ending their lives.
He was a hero to some, but to many, he was the death-obsessed doctor who helped patients end their lives instead of helping them to live.
People were really divided. There were people who were really for this and really against this.
A newspaper reporter asked Dr. Berry for her thoughts.
And I said to the person who was interviewing me, you know, it takes a lot of skill to manage the patients, manage the symptoms of somebody at the end of life, and it takes no skill to write a prescription for Secanol, which was a barbiturate. And I was really worried that that's what would happen, is people would see somebody, oh my gosh, you're suffering. Here's a script. So I was really, you know, worried about that. And that, so that was
doctors weren't being trained well to manage pain. That's what she wanted the focus of end-of-life care to be.
Again, my fear was that doctors who didn't know any better would prescribe lethal medication instead of getting people the help they needed.
Then Dr. Berry starts telling me about some of the patients she was working with at the time. The one she remembers most vividly, the one at the center of her story, is Ginger.
She was 38 years old and diagnosed with a rare form of stomach cancer that usually affects, you know, old men in their 70s who drink and smoke too much. And it was just bizarre that this healthy 38-year woman had been diagnosed. with that disease. And I helped break that news to her family. I was rotating through the cancer clinic, and I did that, and then she started her chemotherapy.
Dr. Barry didn't hear from Ginger for a while. Then she got a call. The chemo wasn't working, so Ginger decided to stop treatment. She asked, "Dr. Barry, could you be my doctor for my end-of-life care?"
I said, what happened to your oncologist? And she said, "Oh, he told me to come back when I wanted more chemo." I mean, this woman with this life-threatening disease had been abandoned by her physician, and it was just appalling to me. So I said, "Of course, I'll be your doctor." And I felt like this woman took me by the hand and showed me how to do what she needed me to do. And it was incredible. I remember the day she came to me with paperwork and she said, "I'd like to sign up with hospice. Would you sign the paperwork for that?"
Ginger got into hospice. And soon after that, she died from her cancer. She didn't use medical aid in dying. This was the 90s. It wasn't legal. But the experience of treating Ginger and listening closely to her needs, well, that changed Dr. Barry.
You know, when I teach, I tell stories, and I tell patient stories. And I almost feel like these people sort of live in me, like Ginger. I mean, I feel so much love for her, you know, in terms of, I feel like she gave me the career that I have.
Dr. Barry went on to work for the University of Vermont as a palliative care doctor and an educator. She also became a staunch supporter of medical aid in dying when it became legal in Vermont, as long as she was sure her patients weren't asking her for it because their pain was being ignored.
Do you remember the first time that a patient came to you and asked for a prescription or asked for information about it?
Well, you know, I literally have had hundreds of people ask me to kill them. I'm not kidding you. I mean, a lot. And I say, well, gosh, you know, you seem to be in a lot of pain. How about if we get your pain under control and then we talk about it then? And, you know, I go back the next day and say, and they're comfortable. And yesterday you were interested in ending your life. And they say, "Oh, no, I'm fine."
If they still really wanted to move forward and learn about their options, Barry said, yes, she'll help. She's prescribed the medication many, many times. And whenever she had a patient who passed away in the way they wanted, Dr. Barry would think about Ginger.
I'm in my 60s, and certainly people who were trained up to the time I was trained, you know, death was failure. Yeah. You know, after Ginger died, I talked to my friend. I said, you know, Ginger died last night, and I know I should feel bad because she died. And of course I feel bad, but I feel really good about what I was able to do for her. You know, feeling good when somebody died was total anathema to medical training. I hope, and I think people trained more recently did not get the message that death is failure. Death is a part of life, and it, you know, we want to make it as good as it can be for people.
One of the things Dr. Barry tries to do is talk to other doctors about becoming prescribers for Act 39. But that's a complicated choice for a lot of physicians, even if they support the concept. This conversation happens a lot in the world of hospice care. Hospice, if you're not familiar, is a special type of care for people with incurable illness. Doctors and nurses who work in hospice help dying patients live as fully and comfortably as possible. There are hospice centers, but patients can also receive hospice care at home. That's what Stanley and Elaine Fitch did. The hospice workers I spoke to were all deeply passionate about their work and their patients. But they said there's still this stigma about hospice that they're constantly coming up against.
People have been sort of confused about the role of hospice care in hastening or not hastening a person's death for a long time. So it keeps.
Dr. Nancy Long is the medical director of the University of Vermont Health Network's Home Health and Hospice. She says there's this fear out there that hospice is somehow going to make you die faster. That's why she chooses not to prescribe for medical aid in dying.
I'm not in the role of a prescriber. You know, as somebody who's practiced in hospice care for over 20 years and watched the evolution of this across the country and sort of had to correct the misunderstanding so many times in my life of what we actually do, and that our intent is never to hasten someone's death. I like there to be a clear line about what my role is.
The University of Vermont doesn't allow its doctors to prescribe for medical aid in dying if they know the patient is going to use it at a UVM facility, like the hospice center in Colchester, where Dr. Long works.
The way I would describe the role of UVM home health and hospice is that we're engaged neutral. Mm-hmm. We're neutral, but we're engaged. In other words, we will help connect a person with the resources they need to do it. As I said, we care for people regardless of what their choices are around this.
Our question asker, Charlie, wanted to know how the medical establishment feels about Vermont's medical aid in dying law. It seems like the answer to that question is still actively evolving. Just ask Dr. Tim Leahy, who heads up UVM Medical Center's clinical ethics program.
I've absolutely seen that evolution. I think it's much more prevalent now for physicians sort of want to know what the patient's goals are. If the patient, for instance, wants quality of life over quantity of life, we view that as our duty and privilege to be able to help them achieve those goals. And I do think that has been a cultural shift over the years.
It's not just doctors and nurses who are reevaluating how they approach the idea of death. Act 39 has spurred people across the state to talk more openly about death and dying, regardless of whether they support the law or not.
The three of us were doing that, and then we started to get help. My parents were so
people like the Fitch sisters, who helped their parents navigate medical aid in dying. Well, they're the role models for that conversation. The sisters told me supporting both their parents through the process of dying was incredibly hard. They basically put their lives on hold for months. But they got through it because they knew they were doing what their parents wanted and because they had each other.
Yeah, and then we were holding their hands when they drifted off.
Mm-hmm. And it was very peaceful. It was like falling asleep.
Yeah. It was very, very graceful.
Yeah, we read some poems to them. We sang to them.
And then after their death, the community completely wrapped their arms around us. Mm-hmm. We had an open house at their farmhouse, and we had my mother's paintings up. We had poems my father had written.
He has my mother's wall of wisdom.
Oh, she'd write these little sayings down on pieces of paper, and I started pasting them up on the wall, and there's a lot of them.
And some were like quotes from literature, like Dostoevsky, or a poem that she liked, but some were some that she wrote herself.
Some were about weight loss.
Of course. And my son is having a Christmas party this weekend, and he's inviting his generation and our generation, and my parents will be on the mantle, and they would just love knowing that there's a party there.
Yeah,
it continues.
It continues.
I'd like to read something that one of our hospice nurses sent to us. You don't have to include it, but it's
she says, "Thank you so much for your note. I learned so much from you, from your parents, and you all. Thank you for all of the reminders you allowed us to see of the power of love, family devotion, and loyalty."
I don't know what happens to people after they die. But I do know that Stanley and Elaine's memory lives on in their family, their community in Calais, and now in all of us. The memory is of how they lived and how they died together. That was a recent episode from Brave Little State. Thanks to Charlie Bastard for the great question. I reported this episode, and it was produced, mixed, and sound designed by Josh Crane. Editing and additional help from the rest of the Brave Little State team, Angela Evansy, Myra Flynn, and May Nagusky. Ty Gibbons composed the theme music, other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Erica Heilman and Chelsea Chalfant. To see photos of the Fitch sisters and their parents, Stanley and Elaine, check out bravelittlestate.org.
While you're there, you can submit your own question about Vermont and check out the episode archive. We're also joined on this bitterly cold Friday by Dr. Jaina Clow. She's a hospice and palliative care physician with the UVM Health Network, a professor of medicine, and a board member of Patient Choices Vermont. They're the advocacy group that led the push to legalize medical aid in dying in the state. Dr. Clow, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, could you tell us a little bit more about what it means to be a hospice and palliative care physician? What do you do?
Oh, my. Well, the work is rich. We really look at our role as support for serious illness, including terminal illness. And, you know, as a physician, I'm part of an interdisciplinary team that includes nurses and social workers and spiritual caregivers. And I think our sort of purpose is really to help alleviate suffering and really understand what people are experiencing and how we can make the transition easier with any serious illness. Mm-hmm.
Well, your mention of alleviating suffering reminds me of an email that we just got from a listener named Virginia who writes, I do elder care, and in 2021, a client had cancer and was in extreme pain. Steve, the pharmacist who we just heard in the Brave Little State episode, Steve came with the medication and went through everything with us. When it was time, a family member and myself were there with the patient in her bedroom as she drank the medication. It was a beautiful experience for all of us. We bathed and dressed her as she wished, and it's a blessing for all when a loved one no longer suffers and goes the way that they choose. So thank you, Virginia, for sharing that. Now, Dr. Clow, I know that you've prescribed the medication for medical aid in dying many times, but your job doesn't always end right after you write that prescription. Often I know you're at the bedside when someone takes these drugs, and I can imagine that must be a really intense and personal experience. I've never had an experience like that. Wondering if you could share a little bit about what it's like to be there for a person, for a patient. Is there one story perhaps that stands out?
Oh, sure. And thank you for that question. And it's interesting to hear you kind of describe the job of writing the prescription. And I would just say that the process and the relationship begins far before that moment of writing the prescription. And it's really a process of supporting someone through medical aid in dying is really just a process of understanding and exploring who the person is and finding out what is most important to them as they face the end of their lives, and really helping support people in kind of self-actualization and sort of meeting their own needs. And sometimes that leads to writing a prescription for medical aid in dying, and sometimes it doesn't. So just to honor that the process of really supporting people through their own learning as they go through the dying process is really most important. And then when it's clear that medical aid in dying is the choice that is right for a person, I think I have had the opportunity to be with people as they've taken the medication and as they've died. And I just feel profound gratitude to be witness to that clarity and self-knowledge that the person has shown to be clear enough to take the step to leave this world. I can think of many stories, but one recent story is a woman that I had worked very closely with, and she had a lot of kind of ambivalence about this process, which is very natural. And she was very clear and very committed, and she had
what do you mean more by ambivalence about this process? What does that mean?
Oh, she just had a little uncertainty. Like she didn't want to die, but she recognized that she was dying. And so there was this sort of uncertainty about when would be the right time. Would she actually go forward with this? So she was kind of holding these two possibilities side by side. And I remember feeling that really strongly, like just with her. And then when she was ready, she was very clear and she took the medication, and her spouse was right by her side. And it was just remarkable. It was very peaceful. She really fell asleep and died within about a half an hour. And she was playing, there was music playing that was important to both her and her spouse. And as the last song finished on this playlist is the moment that she died.
We're speaking right now with Dr. Jana Clough, a physician who specializes in end-of-life care in Vermont. And Dr. Clough, thank you for sharing those experiences with us. I can hear the emotion in your voice, even though I'm sure you've been through this with patients many, many times in the past. But as you said, each situation, each family, each patient is different. And I know that you also do a lot of work to consult with clinicians who have patients who are considering their end of life options. I'm curious what kind of questions that you get most often from fellow doctors, maybe ones who are, getting a patient who is interested in pursuing medical aid in dying and the doctor hasn't dealt with that before.
Yes, that's a great question. And there are many questions. I think the questions are as diverse as the clinicians who are asking them. Commonly, I think it's really just validating that the person is eligible and navigating some of the questions around how mood might impact decision-making capacity. If a person is experiencing grief and the question, is this like a depression that might really impair their decision-making? Just sort of supporting the clinical process of determining eligibility, and also really exploring the clinician's questions around the process itself. So guiding people through the steps, and acknowledging discomfort if clinicians are new to the process and feeling uncomfortable because it's such a new skill set, new conversations, new kind of medical guidelines for them. So it's really a variety of supports and discussion.
Yeah. Well, we have a call now from a listener named Carolyn in Waterville. Carolyn, go ahead. What would you like to share?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was interested to hear that there is some state that is allowing death with dignity for people with Alzheimer's. So I'm curious where that is. Hmm. My husband has a mid-stage dementia. He's not ready in my mind to die now, but he always was very clear that he would want to go before he was in very rough shape. Mm. Where is Vermont with that now? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that call, Carolyn. And we're wishing the best to you and your husband. And Dr. Clough, this is an issue that came up in my reporting a bit. I know there's a push for people with Alzheimer's and their loved ones who say, we should have access to this medication. And right now they don't because, many patients with dementia and Alzheimer's don't fit that requirement of having 6 months or less to live. I know there's other countries, places outside the U.S. where folks can access the medication if they have Alzheimer's and dementia, but currently that is not legal in any of the states here, even the ones that do have a medical aid in dying law on the books. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this or perhaps what you've heard in the medical community about whether this might and should change.
Yes, this is such an important question. I really appreciate the listener calling in. And first and foremost, it's so important to acknowledge the suffering that people can experience with progressive dementia and the losses, both for the person and their family and friends and caregivers. And so I think really most importantly, it's acknowledging that this is a condition that becomes terminal and can create suffering. And I just feel that's most important to acknowledge. And the way eligibility has typically been established in the United States for medical aid in dying is very much dependent on a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And this has been important because in general, when we look at how we recognize dying, we associate it with prognosis. We all know that dying happens in many ways, but for medical illness, we look at a six-month prognosis. It's how we determine hospice eligibility. So that's sort of a familiar construct. And the challenge with dementia is that by the time a person is clearly in those final 6 months of life, they typically don't have decision-making capacity to make such a choice. And so we really have the way eligibility is structured. We don't have a way of really assessing a person's true true agency and decision-making capacity at that time. And again, I think this is an evolving process, and I imagine it will take us some time to develop criteria that could be inclusive for dementia. And I think we just all, as palliative care clinicians, we recognize the suffering of people with dementia and, you know, hope to really support people through this, although I imagine it will be time, a while before it's permanent.
Before it's time, yes. And unfortunately, our time has flown by during this hour. We have many more questions to aim at you, Dr. Clough. But let's end here. When you hear from patients who might just be beginning to have these conversations with family, or family members who don't quite know how to start talking about the process of death and dying, but feel like it's time, what's one piece of advice that you might give for folks who are just beginning these conversations?
Well, I think I often rely on a really basic guidance around trusting oneself, trusting the questions that you have, trusting what you see. Mm. If you see that a person is becoming more ill, and seeking support for starting these conversations, and engaging with people close to you about these questions.
Mm. Well, Dr. Jana Clough, a hospice and palliative care physician with the University of Vermont, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me and for creating this beautiful piece. And if people are interested in more information about medical aid in dying, I will direct them to the patientchoices.org website. And again, thank you so much.